I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Coming up, would adding insects to the Western diet be good for the planet? We have two guests waiting in the wings, so to speak. But first, the worldwide increase in meat consumption. More people are consuming beef, chicken, and pork, and now about a third of the ice-free land on the planet is devoted to livestock production. And that is having dramatic environmental consequences. Our guest, Brian Walsh, has been writing about this for Time magazine, where he covers energy and the environment. And Brian, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. We need to get our guest up. Brian?
Hi, I'm here.
Okay, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Why the increase in meat consumption? And was there a point in time when this began?
Well, I mean, it's something that generally tracks with economic growth around the world. I mean, certainly with the U.S., we saw, I think, meat consumption grow in the post-war era for a while. And then what's really turbocharged this is as economic growth has spread to the rest of the world. So between 1971 and 2010, production of meat globally tripled to about 600 billion pounds. So, you know, that's a lot of meat, a lot more people eating it. And generally, as you start to make more money, eating more meat is one of the first things you do with it.
You wrote, and I quoted you, about a third, almost a third of the Earth's ice-free surface is used for raising meat. I don't even know how to think about that.
Well, I mean, you have to think about the fact that it's not just the pasture land that's needed for cattle or the space that's needed for pigs and chicken. What that really means is so much of the grain that we grow around the world, the farmers grow, whether it's soybeans or corn or anything else they might be feeding these animals, that goes to them. You know, it does not go to human beings. It goes to feed the animals who eventually feed us. And when you look at something like deforestation in Brazil, where there's a lot of cattle pasture land, that often comes from rainforest. So you clear out that land to open up space both to raise soybeans for the animals and also to have pasture land for the animals, and that's the sort of impact you get.
And what about the impact of things like, let's say, the word flatulence coming from cattle?
Right. I mean, that's a huge issue, of course. And, you know, you have a lot of methane that comes out of the cattle. That's a major contributor to greenhouse gases and to climate change. The numbers sort of on trying to figure out what the actual impact of livestock raising on climate change sort of changes. You've seen numbers like 18% in a UN report from a few years back. You've seen higher numbers from some other reports. But clearly, between the direct gases coming out of the animals themselves, between the land changes that are needed to support them, you know, it's a big part of that overall problem.
And are we talking about cattle or livestock raised on small farms or these sort of big agri farms? What are we talking about when we look around the world?
It really depends. And here, obviously, in the U.S., you know, you've seen greater and greater concentration when it comes to raising animals. So you see those CAFOs, those concentrated animal feeding operations, where huge numbers of pigs, huge numbers of chicken, huge numbers of cattle are sort of kept in very small spaces and grown, on one hand, sort of efficiently when you think about the space that's used and the resources that go into them, but also that comes to a lot of other environmental problems as well. But in poor parts of the world, say in sub-Saharan Africa, you need a lot of space to support these animals, and that comes with problems as well. It takes a lot of resources, and so that inefficiency adds to this as well.
In fact, you even wrote that the highest rate of CO2 emissions is in the developing world.
Exactly, yeah. That's simply because you're sort of lacking the efficiency when it comes to getting them feed. And a lot of that's really, it's not so much the animals themselves, it's the lack of efficiency in raising the feed for them. American farmers are obviously incredibly efficient when it comes to raising, you know, things like corn. You can get 150 plus bushels of corn per acre. Not the case in the developing world in many places, both because the land might not be as good, the climate not as good, but also simply the resources aren't there. And that means, you know, you need more space, more energy, more of everything to raise a pound of beef.
And when you compare things like cows and pigs and chickens, which of these animals is more, you know, quote unquote, environmentally friendly?
Generally, the smaller they are, the more, I suppose, efficient they are. You know, it takes a lot more water, it takes a lot more grain to raise, or grass to raise a pound of beef than it does to raise a pound of pork or a pound of chicken. So that's kind of how it goes, you know, and how this is eaten in different parts of the world also makes a difference. In a place like China, pork is much, much more popular than beef. So you've seen a vast number increase in the amount of pigs out there. which has had some problems, not just in terms of obviously environmental consequence, but even health consequences, because you can have diseases that can pass from chickens or pass from pork to human beings as well.
And is there growing concern about just the amount of meat consumption or cattle consumption, but the fact that it is having an environmental impact?
I think so. I mean, it certainly is going to have to be an issue going forward. We're getting to a point where the consequences are so multifaceted. You know, we've talked about greenhouse gases and we talked about space, but in the U.S., you have an issue with antibiotic resistance. You're using a lot. I mean, something like 80% by weight of the antibiotics in America go to animals, mostly to help them grow faster. That has had a huge impact on the rise of antibiotic-resistant infections, which kill thousands of people a year. So all these sort of impacts are there, and it's very hard to unpack them, I think, because people don't really see the connection between the burger they're eating and something like a bacteria that might affect them down the road. But, it's very important, and as meat production increases and becomes more industrial around the world, those problems are going to intensify.
You can see the sort of rise and fall of meat, and I wonder whether if you increase the price for something, are you going to see a reduction of consumption?
Well, it's interesting. We may actually get that experiment this year, because you've seen the price of beef certainly go up. Significantly, mostly due to the drought that we've been having in parts of the Midwest and definitely in Texas for several years now, and that's really driving up the cost to raise those cattle, and then that's going to drive up the cost to eat them. But at the same time, certainly in the U.S. here, food is still incredibly cheap in terms of what we make as our income compared to what it was, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. And that's, at the same time, growth is continuing around the world, and meat is not something people generally want to give up, I think. It might be something else first, but, we've become very accustomed to being able to get meat on a level we didn't have before, and I think you'd have to see prices go up significantly before you'd really see a change in that, I think.
Well, I'm thinking about the price of a fast food meal. I mean, talk about a cheap meal.
Yeah, when it comes to calories, calories in to dollars out, I mean, it's very efficient, and, it's based on the idea that it will be cheap, and those companies have the ability to really push efficiency, push production as much as possible. So you're not going to see, I think, a Happy Meal suddenly start costing $8, $9, $10, and that would defeat the whole business model. So it's not, I think, going to be price that would make a difference there.
And that's Brian Walsh. He covers energy and the environment for Time Magazine. We asked him to join us in the first part of Radio Times today to talk about the worldwide increase in meat consumption. And a bit later on in the hour, we'll be talking about eating bugs. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments, you can certainly join our conversation. Brian, what about faux meat? I mean, the development of meat products that are just, based on non-meat ingredients.
That's becoming a very interesting area of innovation out in Silicon Valley, actually. You're seeing companies, I know Bill Gates invests in one, that are looking to see, well, how can we use non-meat products to create as close to a meat-like substance as we can? Because the reality is people like to eat meat. I mean, this is a really universal phenomena, except for some certainly religious or sort of ethical obligations, I think. So you're seeing that. And then, of course, the holy grail when it comes to that is actually to be able to grow meat, essentially, in the laboratory, produce meat that's identical to the kind we have by actually growing an animal, but avoid the issues of space, avoid the issues of greenhouse gases, and create what would be very efficient, but also, I think, incredibly weird for a lot of people.
Well, and I've tried some of these, quote-unquote, meat products, and, they run the gamut. Some are semi-tasty, some are pretty bad.
Exactly, yeah. There's never been really one that's really, a product that's really stuck, that's, I think, convinced people who would still eat meat. Right now it's basically for people who, whether for health reasons or, again, for ethical reasons, don't want to eat meat. It's okay for them, but if you're talking about the vast number of people who do eat meat, you haven't yet produced the product that will really convince them to maybe put down the hamburger and try something else.
Have you ever eaten a deep-fried and breaded scorpion?
I have, actually.
Really?
I've had that once. Yeah. I did a story on it a few years ago, and it was okay.
What does that mean?
Well, it's not something I would choose just out of other things I like to eat more. It was a little hard to actually get the meat off it. I think that was the biggest challenge. you know, and it was produced great. It didn't taste bad. It was just, you know, it's a lot of work. It's a bit like, you can imagine the work that goes into getting, you know, lobster meat out of a lobster claw, only you're not getting lobster, you're getting scorpion.
Oh, interesting. So a knife and a fork that you had to use to get whatever meat was in there?
Yeah, you kind of had to sort of, or sort of chew it off, which is, you know, a bit certainly, it's, you know, you look at a scorpion, it's not something you want to chow down on, even if it is deep fried. But I've tried a few other things. You know, grubs are not too bad, actually, because they are mostly meat. Things like that. You know, crickets are actually pretty good. You can actually eat them whole. But, you know, again, it's something that really requires you to kind of turn off that disgust factor and actually try it out. And I think it's a big ask for most people.
Well, you have perfectly set us up for the two guests that we have waiting in the wings. Let me get Dale, though, from Landenberg to join us very quickly on Radio Times. Dale, go ahead. Put your question to Brian Walsh.
Yeah, thanks so much. He does a good job of describing our current industrial agriculture system as, and the meat part of it, as, you know, really rough on the environment. But you asked him which animals are worse on the environment. I think that's the wrong question asked. The answer to all this is it depends not on the animals but on the system. There are ways to sequester carbon and build great, great soils and food. There's a great book called Cows Save the Planet that goes into this. So can you talk about how you can grow food and restore the environment at the same time?
Dale, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Brian, go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, if you look at raising cattle on grass, and 100% grass, not sort of what we do now, which is grass for a while and then put them on corn, I mean, that can be better for the environment. It can be better in terms of reducing the sort of greenhouse gas impact, better also healthier as well. The challenge, though, is if you wanted to, I think, take all the cattle that are currently raised in the United States conventionally and move them to grass, that would take up a lot of space. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you start taking up space, then you start often sort of removing forests, you start clearing other land. I mean, space is the single most sort of scarce resource on the planet. We're not making any more of land. So anytime we need to increase that space, that carries some risk with it as well.
And in the minute, couple of the seconds that we have left here, and we are going to be talking about eating insects after the break, is that something you think that's under serious consideration, Brian?
You know, it's something that people experiment with, and maybe there, I could see somewhere down the line figuring out some way to create, you know, snacks or things like that that might be a protein supplement, especially for those who you know, for the global poor, perhaps. But to me, the only thing that would really make a big difference on this would be that lab-grown meat, where if you can actually just replicate the experience we have now with normally grown meat and do it in a lab, maybe that would make a difference. That's something, again, that's still pretty science fiction as well.
Well, as always, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And that's Brian Walsh, and he covers energy and the environment for Time Magazine. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and yes, we will be talking about eating insects. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol abuse? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia and the Main Line by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
Jenny Slate stars in the upcoming movie Obvious Child. Her character gets dumped, fired, and finds out she's pregnant all at about the same time. She and the movie's director had seen Juno and Knocked Up and liked those movies a lot, but
we're also hoping to see a story that we haven't seen yet, where a woman decides to have an abortion and isn't feeling bad about herself for that specific reason.
Jenny Slate, the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Why do we, in 2014, still rely on resumes and cover letters in the hiring process? Critics say they're a waste of time and biased.
You can't tell just from credentials whether or not someone's going to be a good employee.
Is it time to kill the resume? We'll ask next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Human beings have always incorporated insects in their diet. They are a popular delicacy, even a staple, in many non-Western countries. Now there's an effort to get the rest of the world, including Americans, to at least consider cooking up some crickets or some waxworms or bees or ants or even a scorpion for a tasty meal. But first, they have to get over the yuck factor. That's why we invited Penn psychology professor Paul Rosin to join us on Radio Times. He's an international authority on disgust and the nature and origins of food preferences. It's been a couple of years, and Paul Rosin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Danielle Martin, and she's the author of a new book. It's called Edible, An Adventure into the World of Eating Insects and the Last Great Hope to Save the Planet. She's the host of Girl Meets Bug, an insect cooking and travel show, and she also blogs about bugs for the Huffington Post, and she joins us from Minnesota Public Radio from their studios. And Danielle Martin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Let me begin with you, if I could. And I watched a video of you yesterday cooking and deep frying a breaded scorpion. You were careful not to eat the poisonous tail. And I saw you chewing on it, a kind of a crunchy meal. What did it taste like?
You know, it's so funny. Brian Walsh, your previous guest, was just referring to it as being kind of like lobster, as looking kind of like a lobster. To me, it tastes a great deal like a very light, earthy lobster. You do have to get through the shell.
Yes.
But I think that a good comparison to keep in mind is that lobsters are bottom feeders. They're scavengers. They're eating the dead bodies of other fish. They're eating, you know, fish feces. Whereas a scorpion eats all of its prey live. So, I think that's important to keep in mind.
Well, I have to say that as I looked at it, and I'm not particularly squeamish about bugs, but as I looked at that video of you, Daniela, I did sort of grimace. Did you have to get over that for yourself?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was terrified. In fact, shortly before shooting that video, I read online that certain species of scorpion can go into the deep freeze for up to a couple of weeks, come out, thaw, and reanimate.
Oh, Lordy.
So, I actually had to call my friend David George Gordon, who wrote the Eat a Bug cookbook, to make sure that this probably wouldn't happen, as my scorpion is thawing and I'm getting ready to bread and fry it, that it's not going to come back to life and sting me. So, yeah, I was nervous. Let's put it that way.
Let me get Paul Rosin in on the conversation. And we've had you on the show before talking about taste preferences and things like disgust. What is that yuck factor about? And as I said, I sort of had that as I was watching Daniela cook up this scorpion.
Well, it's a universal reaction to probably in its core animal products. Almost everything that people call disgusting cross-culturally is an animal product. And the issue with insects is interesting because they're the rule, not the exception. If you think of Americans, we eat the muscle of pig, cow, and lamb sometimes. There are over 4,000 species of animals. We find all the rest of them disgusting.
Right.
We find all the reptiles, all the amphibians, many fish, all the invertebrates with a few exceptions like clams and octopus. So we're basically disgusted by almost every animal, and insects are in that category. So the issue is, why do we suspend disgust when we eat beef or pork? And one reason we do is that we're not thinking of a cow when we eat beef.
We're thinking of this piece of something, this slab of something that's in front of us.
Yeah, and a lot of people go to some effort, and so does the marketing, food marketers. For example, a little child, 4-year-old, goes to the meat section. They would have no idea that a piece of red stuff with a little white fat on it is a piece of a cow.
But if we have a scorpion in our hand, as Daniela had, there's no getting around the fact that we're about to eat a bug.
Well, there is a way to get around it, and that's to use insect flour, which in terms of human acceptance is much more effective. It's just like other flour. It's better protein content, and you could put it in things instead of wheat. The problem with it is it doesn't replace meat as an experience. It replaces meat as a nutritive substance.
And Danielle, you talk about flour. I mean, the various ways that insects can be, I guess, ground up and put into other food or used as a kind of a food substitute. Can you expand on that?
Certainly. This again, is a very old idea. This is something that has been going on since early Native American life here in the U.S. One of the very first versions of an energy bar, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, is something called pemmican, which is basically crushed meat or, in certain cases, ground insects with things like berries and nuts. And this was something that they would use as kind of a trek food when they were out hunting or traveling. This is something they would eat along the way. So it's kind of the early version of a power bar. And interestingly, in areas that, so this was something that was very typical in a place like Utah. And then today in Utah, there is a company called Chapul, which is using essentially this very same technology to make insect flour protein bars.
You know, I'm looking at a table here where you compare the protein and the fat, the calcium, the B12, things like crickets and mealworms and waxworms, comparing it to beef and fish, salmon, for instance, chicken even. And protein-wise, a mealworm, you know, beats out chicken and beats out salmon.
It's pretty impressive, actually. Several of the farmed insects, there's, you know, basically a handful of species that are typically farmed in today's world. You'll have to pardon me. I'm pregnant.
Oh, you are. You're not having a baby or anything, are you?
Not currently, but I am having some morning sickness.
Oh, dear.
So I am
trying
to get
some little
segment.
Insect powder would help you out there, Danielle. I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm trying to get through this segment without barfing, as
oh, dear.
I'm sure some of your listeners can relate. There's about, you know, a handful of species that are farmed in today's world. There's crickets, waxworms, mealworms, and a couple of other less popular varieties. The idea is that these insects are typically so much higher in the types of nutrients that we typically turn to meat for, things like B12, zinc, calcium, iron, and even protein, that it's kind of like those old Total commercials. You have to eat this many bowls of the competition cereal to equal this many bowls of Total. It's the same thing with insects.
Well, I think it's absolutely perfect that you feel like barfing as we're talking about eating insects. And we have a world authority on disgust who's across from me here, Paul Rosin. Let me turn to you, Paul, because we posted a video of Daniela preparing a mealworm pizza on our Facebook page. And I'm told we're already getting responses to it. And basically the responses are, yuck. Is there something, I mean, I think you can put maybe a cricket in one category and perhaps sort of a wormy kind of creature in another category. Do we have different responses like that?
There are certainly different degrees of disgust and generally gooey, wet things like a worm, because people think of a mealworm as a worm, not as an insect or a caterpillar. So people love butterflies, but they don't like caterpillars, which are, of course, pre-butterflies. So generally speaking, if you're thinking of eating a whole insect, something like a cricket, which is crispy and doesn't have the sense of having goo in it, would be more acceptable. I think there are two general approaches to this problem. One is taken by the Nordic Lab, which is related to the famous restaurant Noma in Copenhagen, and they are trying to make insects delicious. They take pupa of bees and they make ceviche and do sorts of things to try to make it, integrate it into fine food, and some of the top restaurants like Noma serve insects. The other approach is to come sneak up from the bottom, put a little bit in, which most people will take 0.1% insect flour in their chocolate chip cookies.
Right.
You know, you won't taste anything.
Right.
And by the way, insects taste rather mild. So there's two approaches, and the issue really is whether you're focusing on the developing world, where there's a real shortage of protein and nutrient, for which insects are a really important solution, where you could certainly put them in the flour. And our world, where we treat them more like sushi, you know, they're sort of a trendy food. Now, sushi has become extremely successful in the United States.
Yes.
It's the 10th most popular food, and it is raw fish. It is disgusting. But people have overcome that. So it's a model for what you might be able to do with insects.
But is that just good marketing, or if you actually try it, it actually tastes good? I mean, that you sort of over time introduce yourself to foods that you might not want to eat?
First impression? Yeah, there are things that, like chocolate, if someone is reluctant to eat it, if you can get it in their mouth, you win, because it tastes so good. Now, with insects, you've got the problem that the idea of eating them is bad, so that people might not like the taste of cricket, but if they didn't know it was a cricket, they might like the taste.
Right.
So you have to get by that, too. But things like crickets are very nice snacks. They're crispy. They're eaten as snacks in a lot of in Southeast Asia and other places. So they're pretty appealing. They're like potato chips in a way, you know.
Well, it sounds like you've eaten them.
Yes.
And enjoyed that.
Yes.
And that's Paul Rodson. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. He studies the nature and origins of food preferences, including the psychology of disgust. In fact, he's been advising a group of researchers in Denmark on ways to cultivate positive preferences for things like insects. Daniela Martin, also with us, author of a book called Edible, An Adventure into the World of Eating Insects and the Last Great Hope to Save the Planet. She is not feeling so well because she's pregnant. She might even throw up on the show. Who knows? She's also the host of Girl Meets Bug, an insect and cooking and travel show, and she blogs about bugs for the Huffington Post. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Daniela, let me go back to you. And you were really introduced to eating bugs when you were living in Mexico, right?
That's right. For my undergraduate degree in anthropology, I was studying pre-Columbian nutrition. What I wanted to see was what vestiges of early native cuisine had survived to the present day, what things the early Aztecs and Maya had been eating that they were still eating today. And Mexico is a great place to study this. Unlike in our part of the Americas, where native food has kind of gone by the wayside, it is still very much alive in Mexico today. And one of those vestiges that they ate, you know, hundreds of years ago and that they still eat today is insects.
Mm.
And so for me, that was a wonderful sort of portal to the past.
And
I had a... Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and what was your first meal, so to speak?
So the first time I got to taste them, I was in Oaxaca. And there was a woman by the side of the road selling chapulines, which is a kind of a toasted chili lime grasshopper. And I bought a little bag of them, and I went to sit down at a cafe because I knew I was going to need something to wash that down with. And I poured my little bag of bright red grasshoppers out onto my tablecloth to take a picture. And the next thing I knew, I was surrounded by native Trique indigenous kids off of the street who'd come in to eat my grasshoppers right off my table. And as a young anthropology student, to have that moment of cultural immersion, you know, plus I love kids, was just... It was incredibly inspirational, and from that moment on, I've just been fascinated by the topic.
And did you love the grasshoppers?
You know, I didn't. My first taste, I think, was a bit biased, and they tasted kind of like a sour potato chip. Wasn't my favorite, but the next time that I cooked bugs, I cooked them myself with my own recipe, and that time I liked them a lot.
And what goes well with grasshopper?
I think
a nice light white wine or something like that?
Yeah. Well, actually, I think beer, goes extremely well with most bugs because the flavors of insects are typically nutty, maybe a little shrimpy, kind of mushroomy, very earthy flavors. So I think these pair exceptionally well with beer.
Paul, go ahead, Danielle.
Well, grasshoppers, actually, I think insects in that kind of family go very well with garlic.
Ah, everything goes well with garlic, though. I think we should say
that's
Paul.
Correct. I would say that was true. By the way, my first experience with insects was also in Oaxaca, as it happens. Uh-huh. I was working in a little village trying to understand how children got to like chili pepper, and I was living in the village, and I had, I was eating what they ate as long as it was cooked, and I had some grubs. I don't know what the source was.
Yeah.
But in a typical Mexican preparation with tomatoes and chili pepper, it was very good. But, I mean, it was more the whole flavor that was good. And I also had some grasshoppers there. And that was my... So we've had... Danielle
Similar.
And I have had this first same experience in the same location. So I just wanted to mention another thing about this. There's an ethical issue here. There's an environmental ethical issue that many people feel that, you know, the environment is a moral responsibility. And insects are clearly better for the environment than than normal meat. But in addition, killing. A lot of people are upset about killing cows and pigs. Some of them become vegetarians, but many of them remain omnivores. Like me, I'm an omnivore, but I don't like the idea that I'm eating a killed pig. And I don't mind raising crickets and eating them. The ethical issue seems to be less potent. And there's really a lot of this. A lot of people who are not comfortable eating meat, though they eat it.
But is that because crickets don't have fur? I mean, is it sort of we have a sort of an affiliation with pigs and cows and chickens?
Yeah, we can see them. We can feel them, that they feel pain. We don't think of insects in the same way. It's a question whether insects feel pain, of course. But also you can raise insects very efficiently, giving them a pretty natural environment. A free-range grasshopper doesn't take a lot of space up, whereas a free-range cow does. So the ethical issues of raising insects are much weaker than the ethical issues for animals.
Daniel, let me pick up on that, because it's clear that you love insects. I mean, I've been watching some of your videos and certainly reading your book and some of your blog as well. So do you feel by eating something that you love that there's some moral ethical issue for you?
No.
Okay, fair enough. Just checking.
I do love insects, and the more I eat them, the more I appreciate and respect them. I definitely want to agree with what Paul was just saying. Some of the ethical issues, I think, are lessened because insects have really short lifespans. A cricket, for instance, lives 3 to 4 months and spends most of that time either growing or reproducing. Mm. Whereas cows can live, you know, I think probably at least a decade.
How you doing up there? How you doing over there in Minnesota?
I'm holding up. I think I'm in a very unique position of someone who's already quite nauseous and has to talk in detail about eating bugs.
But that's not, this is your fate in life, though, Danielle.
That's not a problem for you, Danielle, because for you, they're not nauseating, right? It's just your audience.
Well, right. You know, this is the first time. You know, I've heard people say, oh, eating bugs is gross. Right, I'm sure, Paul, you're all over this. This is your whole thing. And this is a fairly typical, if typically untested, opinion of eating bugs. And I had never been able to relate to it before because I'm open-minded and I think I'm fairly logical about what I put in my mouth. And it's the first time in my life that I can finally go, yep, that does seem a little gross. So I'm pretty sure it'll just be temporary. And yes, I do plan to feed my child bugs, in case anyone's wondering.
That was my next question. Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. And again, that's Daniela Martin. We are talking about some things in her new book. It's called Edible, An Adventure into the World of Eating Insects and the Last Great Hope to Save the Planet. She's the host of a cooking and travel show called Girl Meets Bug. And she also blogs about bugs for the Huffington Post. Paul Rosin with us here in our Philadelphia studio, professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, studies the nature and origins of food preferences and the psychology of disgust. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break.
Whether you're just waking up or you're on your commute, the news is always happening. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Jennifer Lynn. WHYY and NPR's reporters are covering the stories around the block and across the globe that will fuel your day and keep you informed.
So if your alarm is set to 90.9 or we're the first preset on your car's radio,
it's radio so vibrant you can almost see it.
And our reporters never take shortcuts.
Morning Edition, weekday mornings on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Joaquin Phoenix. He stars in the new film The Immigrant, and his film Her is out on DVD. We'll talk about his movies, his life, and his public image, like as an actor who hates to be interviewed.
I will make you another promise. Okay. I promise never to ever make you go through this again.
Actually, he's totally enjoyable in this interview. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Misogyny is not necessarily macho.
We're allowed to have girls in our dorm room?
Not girls, Gil. Women. We're college men now.
He's in college grade.
It's going to be a great year.
A champion of nerd culture discovers how getting the girl can be a dangerous idea after the shooting in Santa Barbara. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're talking about eating insects with Paul Rosin and Daniela Martin. And we have callers coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Paul, I want to just toss this to you and then we'll get to some of our callers. We have some emails as well. I'm assuming that if we went to a slaughterhouse and we saw how that meat ended up at the supermarket, we would be thoroughly disgusted. And yet, I don't know if we can't go, we don't want to go. Is there a certain level of denial you think at work when it comes to disgust and eating meat?
There's an enormous amount of denial, and there's a reason that you can't get a tour of slaughterhouses. Actually, when I was a little kid, I'm a pretty old guy, you could, but you can't now, and the whole thing is very compartmented. And even the killing of animals, there's a very interesting ethnography of a French slaughterhouse by Vial, and she shows that in the slaughterhouse, nobody really kills the cow. There's a sequence of acts that occur. So it's like with an execution when you have a firing squad and somebody has a blank. The whole idea, even in the situation, is sort of, you know, diluted. So the problem is not to think about the source of your food. This is not just about meat, by the way.
Right.
It's about other things, too. We deny, when you sit in an audience, in a crowd, you are breathing the air that they just breathed out. Now, that's not nice. If they breathed into your mouth, you'd be disgusted. Well, they're just right next to you. They're only 2 feet away, but somehow you just don't think about it. So what we do is that, and one thing we do in our culture is we don't name the meat for the animal. So we call it beef. We don't call it cow. Now, in Spanish, it's carne de res. It's meat of cow. But we use a word like beef or pork. We don't do this all the time, but we do it for chicken.
As opposed to pig.
Yeah, but we don't. We say chicken and fish. But the point is we have some words which are different from the animal in which they're coming from. So there's a whole set of ways in which we manage not to think about this. And I think for insects, thinking about the insect farm and the freezing or whatever they would do to kill the insects is not as upsetting. Mm.
Danielle, just a quick question for you, then I do want to get to our callers here, because in your book you talk about having some extraordinary meals, including, I think it was in Japan, having the best insect dish you had ever tried. Do you remember that?
I sure do. For research for this book, I traveled to Japan, Thailand, Cambodia, Denmark, and the Netherlands. And I had great bugs to eat in every single place, but I'm a little biased because I grew up in Japan from the ages of about 9 to 14, so some of my palate was formed then.
Right.
But the Japanese have a very delicate way of respecting the main ingredient and kind of complementing it instead of changing it into something wholly different. That worked extremely well, I felt, with the insects that they prepared. And I got to eat everything from, you know, wasp larvae, kind of rice balls to, there's a very dangerous wasp. It's the most dangerous animal in Japan. It's a giant hornet called O Suzumebachi, which means basically giant sparrow bug.
Wow.
And somebody brought in an entire nest of those. So we got to eat fresh giant hornet sashimi, at one of the underground bug eating parties in Tokyo that I attended. If you don't mind, I actually wanted to address something that you guys were talking about regarding slaughtering. And one of the great energy savings of eating insects instead of these other forms of livestock is actually on the slaughter side. There's an incredible amount of resources, especially water, that go into the slaughtering side, the processing side of the meat that we eat. There's a lot of bones that get removed, skin that gets removed, eyes, teeth, chickens, its feathers. This is a big process. It's a very big energy consumption as well as resources. Insects save almost all of that. As Paul was saying, their main method of slaughter is freezing. Since they're cold-blooded, they basically just go to sleep. It's a very humane killing process. And then they're ready. There is no deboning, no defeathering, no beheading, none of that. There may be grinding up, but you're getting the whole animal. And there's a lot of nutritional benefits to eating nose to tail in that sense as well. So I just wanted to interject that.
No, fair enough. Let me get Chris from Frankfurt to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to throw in that my experience was not in an exotic locale. I was a rec director, rec leader, one at a small South Philadelphia playground area, and we had a Cambodian festival a couple of years ago, and it was quite well attended. There were a couple thousand people, and I was walking around, you know, and I saw someone cooking up a big pot of crickets and water beetles. And everyone else seemed to be enjoying them, and so I decided to cross the threshold, you know, so to speak, and had myself a few, and then I went back into my office with a big bowl of them.
They were that good?
They were quite. Oh yeah, they were that good. They were crunchy and spicy. A lot of really hot spice in them. They were objectionable, except that you know you had to look at them a little bit and get used to that. I bought that another bowl home in my, you know, enlightened state. I thought I'd make an offering to the family, but that was not well received. So.
Fair enough. But, sometimes it's an acquired taste. Chris, no, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. How much do you think appearance counts, Paul Rosin?
Appearance counts a lot. Just imagine eating a whole cow or slicing a piece off and cooking it. It makes a lot of difference, and that's why, for acceptance purposes, I think the flour is very promising because the taste is not, it's not, minced eggs don't taste bad. I mean, they're not very strong tasting or anything. So the flour is sort of innocuous. The idea of making them delicious is also possible, but they don't taste like meat. Mm. They just, if they're made really well, they just taste like a delicious thing. They're not like the imitation meat you can get four blocks from here in Harmony Chinese Vegetarian, which they actually make mock duck where it has some of the chewy property of meat. That's a little different. Insects don't taste like meat. They just are nutritively like meat.
Daniela, is there a bug that you think actually does taste terrible?
Canned silkworms are the worst thing I've ever put in my mouth, bar none. Fresh silkworms taste like popcorn, but canned, the kind you can get in a Korean market known as bondaegi, worst thing I've ever tasted.
Oh, dear. And I know.
I've had them. I don't think they're bad.
Not so bad?
They're popular.
I was just at a meeting of 400 people in Wageningen in Holland, which is the center of insect eating research. And there were 400 people at that meeting. And there were various vendors, including Chirp, which makes chips, and Exo, you know, things like that, the bars. And there was a vendor from Japan who was selling silkworm pupa. That's when you get them that's when you get the silk, so you have the pupa left. But he was selling them. They were sort of in soy sauce. Wow. They were steeped in it. And they were actually a little chewy, which maybe is what Daniela didn't like, but that made them a little bit like meat.
I mean, looking into the future, are we talking about insect farms? I mean, can you imagine something like that, Danielle?
Oh, that's already happening.
Is it?
Oh, yes. They've got one in Canada already that is strictly for human consumption. Cricket Farm. It's known as, I think it's Next Millennium Farms. We have one starting up here in Minneapolis. It's not quite into production mode yet, but that's soon. So that is definitely already on the rise.
There was one in Wageningen we visited at the meeting, which was a mealworm farm. It was an enormous warehouse just filled with drawers filled with mealworms. From what I gathered at the meeting, in many ways the most efficient insect to use is the black soldier fly because it has a shorter life cycle than others. And, of course, you eat the larva, so you don't have to wait till it grows up. And they also eat anything. Like crickets, they sort of eat anything. Mealworms need a diet that most of which could be eaten by humans, too.
Let me get Carl from West Oak Lane to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Carl. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
First, I wanted to make a comment about your first guest. I think he was off in some of his comments.
You know what, Carl? If you don't mind, only because our first guest isn't here and we're really talking about bugs and insects, can you focus your comment or question on what we're talking about now? Oh, we got rid of him. I'm sorry to do that to you, Carl. We have an email from Melissa. Why don't we find meat that resembles their original form disgusting, i.e. chicken wings? And that's a question to you, Paul Rosin.
This is an interesting point. I remember my six-year-old son at dinner one night when chicken was being served, and he looked at it and he said, "It's a chicken!"
Oh,
I mean, he
right.
never made that connection, even though the word was there. So the chicken wing doesn't look like a chicken. Now, in many cultures, you get the whole chicken, including the head, and you actually buy it at the market and they kill it for you. We have, you know, mostly we see these pink chicken breasts and legs. So I think the reason the wing doesn't bother you is it doesn't make you think chicken.
Mm. Can I quote something else from your book, Daniela? And this is something you write saying, it's a simple fact that many of the bugs we hate the most are the ones that eat what we eat, the ones that perhaps even compete with us for food. I thought that was an interesting comment.
Well, I spent a good deal of time when writing this book trying to divine what caused the big bug breakup. I mean, this is something that we have always eaten throughout human evolution. There's virtually never been a time when people weren't eating bugs. And that includes modern day America. We're still eating bugs, except they're just ground up in our food supply, so we're not aware of it. And so one of the avenues I kind of went down was, well, perhaps, you know, when we started being involved in agriculture. Excuse me.
Oh, my God. This is the first, Danielle, ever. Go ahead. Soldier on.
I'll soldier on. when the agricultural revolution started, that may have been a point when insects ceased to be seen as part of the protein mm-hmm. that we ate every day and as an enemy to the crops we were trying to grow. So that's definitely a possibility. And different cultures have dealt with it in different ways. There are some places like Thailand and certain countries in Africa where the pests that feed on the crop fetch a higher market price than the crop itself.
Wow. And I wonder, with Paul, I mean, we have an FDA and, you know, we have food inspectors and all that, but I'm assuming we're probably eating bugs.
Well, not only are we, you have to, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has rules about how much bug residue you can have in flour because you can't get rid of them. I wanted to comment on what you just, the quote you cited, because the quintessential disgusting insect in this country is probably the cockroach. And I think what Daniela was referring to there is that cockroaches are like humans. They eat everything. Wherever you find the human, you'll find the cockroach. I mean, because we both manage to find something to eat. So we should admire them in a way, but we don't.
But we don't. Let me get Alice.
We should admire them. Cockroaches actually are impressively familial. They spend quite a lot of time on their young. They're more like us than we care to know.
No, that's a good thing to know. Let me get, I think it's Allison, is it, from New Jersey, joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Allison. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi there.
I'm really appreciative of the conversation.
Sure.
Because I also lived in Oaxaca. I love Chapulines.
Oh, wow.
But the point I wanted to bring up was when people in the U.S., you know, counter me and say, oh, bugs are so gross, is I bring back up, well, you eat things like Twinkies that have, they're finding out, you know, more than comfortable amounts of chemicals and formaldehydes, the chemical that they found in, like, the Subway rolls. And I was just curious, like, why do people find bugs more disgusting than some of these bizarre ingredients we're starting to use?
Well, that's a question for you, Paul Rosin.
Well, the answer is that, first of all, formaldehyde doesn't have an embodiment like an ant or a grasshopper, but also people do not find dangerous things disgusting. They don't find cyanide disgusting. They find it scary. But fear and disgust are quite different. Disgust has something to do with animalness, and fear has to do with something that's threatening to you, which sometimes is an animal. But
thanks for the call, Allison. Let me squeeze Gary from South Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Gary. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I have two questions quick. How about pest insects like locusts? Could they be like harvested when they're on their swarms? And how about insects? Are there any insects that are kosher?
That are kosher. Well, you know, Daniela.
The answer is yes.
But go ahead, Daniela.
The answer is yes.
That's great.
I've educated a rabbi or two on that fact. It depends on your translation of the Leviticus section of the Torah.
Ah.
But in some versions, only very specific types of locusts and crickets are considered edible.
And in other versions, as long as it's got its back legs up above its body, it's good to go. So I do see at least, especially crickets and grasshoppers, as being kosher.
You want to add to that? Go ahead, Daniela.
So the question was, can locusts be harvested for food? And the answer is absolutely. As recently as last year in Saudi Arabia, officials were warning citizens not to catch and eat the locusts this year because they may have come into contact with pesticides.
Oh.
So as recently as, 2013, this was still being done. This has happened absolutely over the last century in places like Yemen, other places in the Middle East. The Native Americans used to do it. The pilgrims are sitting there and the locusts are eating all their crops and they're complaining. Meanwhile, the Native Americans are gathering the bounty.
Go ahead, Paul Ryan.
Just another point about that to reinforce what Daniela says. You don't normally talk about what you can eat and what you can't if it's obvious. So nobody says you can't eat rocks because nobody thinks of eating them. So the fact that the Leviticus says that there are four kinds of locusts that you can eat is probably motivated by the fact that people are eating them and it's okay. And the reason people were eating them then is presumed that when they swarmed, they were all over the place.
Well, we could go on, but we have to end our discussion. Daniela Martin, thank you for making it through this hour of Radio Times. A real trooper there. You made it. So go take care of yourself. And author of a book called Edible, An Adventure into the World of Eating Insects and the Last Great Hope to Save the Planet. Paul Rosin, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
And he's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Go to our Facebook page. We have posted a video of our guest Daniela preparing a mealworm pizza and tell us what you think about it. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can take care of that. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Joyce Lieberman, the supervising engineer. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.